Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, our lineup reflects the diversity of the local food and drink scene here in Central Indiana, from a tiny tamale business to a new headquarters for green bean delivery. We'll talk with Rita Franco, who has a tamale business called La Mexi Gringa, and who is also launching a shared space commercial kitchen. And we'll hear about the growth of green bean delivery from co-owner and CEO Matt Ewer, and we'll find out where the company is headed. And we'll also talk cocktails and competition with bartender Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar, who recently competed in the Diageo World Class Bartending Competition in Cleveland. We'll hear about what happens during a bartending competition, and Ryan will also tell us how he goes about building a new cocktail. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we cover everything from restaurants and chefs to farmers and food artisans of all sizes, from the newest startups to the most established local companies. And that's the kind of range we're spotlighting in today's show. So first up, we'll be talking with Rita Franco of La Mexi Gringa Tamale Business, and now of The Flippin' Kitchen, a new shared commercial kitchen space at 6129 East Washington Street. I stopped by this space recently to find out how Rita came to be making tamales and how she hopes to help other food entrepreneurs at The Flippin' Kitchen. Tell me first a little bit about how the business started and how you kind of got into making tamales.
So the business name is La Mexi Gringa, and my best friend's from Mexico, and me and her would, for the past 7 years, we would be at home one weekend and we would just make about 150 tamales and sell them just to kind of to friends and family. We'd usually do it after Christmas to make up for what we spent.
So the business took off?
Yes. Yeah, it did. I accidentally started a business because I really didn't mean to. Just some amazing people in the neighborhood found out about me, and all of a sudden my Facebook page grew from 100 to 600. So then I just decided that it's probably time to walk into starting a business.
So tell me, is this like the inspiration for your business?
So a bill came up that was due that I had not budgeted for when I was, you know, at home with my four kids. And I am an entrepreneur, so I was getting on Facebook and I'm like, I will prep your food, I'll clean your house, whatever you need, just, you know, help me make some money. And Garcia from 16th and Emerson with Garcia's Hot Dogs, he private messaged me and he said, amiga, make tamales. And I said, well, that's hilarious, because number one, like I said, he is Mexican and he's telling a white girl to make tamales. That's funny. That was just, I feel like that was God just laughing and saying, go ahead and try this. And I did. And I put it on Facebook, and within 1 hour, I had 200 tamales sold, and I had to cut it off, and I was hyperventilating because I could barely sell 150 between me and my friend every year for 6 years prior to that. So it just took off. I mean, it just was just the right time. And that's why I say it was an accidental business. I did not know 200 tamales were about to be ordered in 1 hour.
Now, that's just nuts. So you put it out on Facebook you know, and that's what it took?
Yes, that was all it took. Use your Facebook, guys. If you want to build a business, use Facebook. It's awesome.
How did that go, you know, in starting a business? You know, was it hard? Was it challenging?
There's always been a burning desire in me and I knew I was an entrepreneur. So there's always been a burning desire to have a business, but I didn't know it would start so quickly. So I'm a mother of four, and I was just used to being at home, cleaning, cooking, whatever. But this is actually really fun, this business concept and all of the ventures that I've been going through to figure out how to do it is awesome.
Now, tell me about how you very first got it started, because that's kind of inspired what you're doing now, right?
Yeah. So how I very first got started, well, I just walked into the business community not knowing a daggone thing and running into walls and trying to figure out what I was doing, feeling my way through, walking around blindly, and some amazing people have helped me out through the way.
So did you hit some snags or some difficulties that you had to navigate through?
Yeah. Well, you know, paying people too much when you don't know that you can do it for free or that there's resources out there to help you.
Well, you know, like, you know, small business resources, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. There's small business resources like SCORE and BOI. Those are some huge helpers to me right now. And actually, I've started on my second venture, which connects to La Mexi Gringa, the kitchen that I'm working out of. I have now turned into a community kitchen.
Well, now tell me about that, because that's very interesting. We have so many food entrepreneurs these days, and they do need space to work, right?
So now my heart is so excited about this, because now I can help the people that are just like I was, coming out of their home, knowing that they have, first of all, a great product, second of all, a passion for the culinary, you know, world or industry. And now, I mean, I have a lot of answers now, so I can share them with people. It's so cool. And then I have this facility that I was blessed with by my stepdad.
Well, now, tell me how that came about, how you came to have your community kitchen and what it's called and where it is.
So the community kitchen came about by, it was me and my stepdad, Chef Dan, who we would work out of here together. It was his catering kitchen, and now he has moved into a restaurant in Irvington, and he allowed me to take over this space and turn it into the community kitchen.
It's on East Washington Street, right? And in a part of town where people, there's probably not a lot of resources for this sort of thing, and so I think it's probably going to hit an untapped market. So have you had a lot of interest so far?
I have definitely had a lot of interviews that I was able to find a lot of different people that are looking for this on this side of town, on the east side of town, in the Irvington-ish area, close to the south side.
Well, tell me the kind of tamales that you make, the different kinds.
Well, we play around with flavors during the fall months. We do a lot of sweets like pumpkin spice and apple pie. I've done peach cobbler. But the traditional tamales that I make are pork with green salsa, chicken with red or green salsa. I do some bean and cheese. I do some rajas, which are veggies with some spicy peppers and cheese. Yeah.
It's great. So the neighborhood is, you know, has embraced the business, right?
The neighborhood has embraced the business, and actually it's expanded all the way out to, I think a guy came from Geist for the holidays and bought 40 tamales from me. So they're just not easy to find in Indiana, actually. You got to know where to go to find a tamale, and I think my tamales are pretty decent, but if you ever see a little old Mexican lady sitting in a parking lot selling out of the trunk of her car, you should buy from her, because they're probably way better.
Now, walk me through the basic ingredients of a tamale. What do you have here?
Okay, so the basic construction of a tamale would be you'd have your masa, you'd have your...
And explain, the masa is...
Masa is a corn dough that you are going to put in a corn husk, and you'll steam it for a Mexican tamale. And then you will, so before you do all that, you'll take your masa and you'll scoop it out and put it into a corn husk and flatten it out just a little bit. And then you will take some filling of your choice. I have beans right here. Beans and cheese is what one of the tamales that I do. If you have chicken or meat, you would take your chicken and you would put salsa on top. So you put that inside of your masa. And you'll just fold it over inside of the corn husk and roll it up, which I can show you how to do during class. And then you'll put it in a special tamale steaming pot, and they'll steam. Steam for about 20 to 30 minutes.
And that's it?
Well, that's kind of it. That's the construction of a tamale, and that's what you'll learn in Basic Tamale 101. Yeah.
So... But now, for the classes, you've got all these things prepared for everyone, right? So they do the pudding together, right?
Yes, I will show them how to make the masa so that they can go home and make masa and put whatever they want inside of it. And then the rest of it's just like a really fun cooking show. Everything's prepped for them and ready so they can put their own tamales together with no hassle and have fun.
We've been talking with entrepreneur Rita Franco of La Mexi Gringa and The Flippin' Kitchen. For more information, look for La Mexi Gringa and The Flippin' Kitchen on Facebook. Since Green Bean Delivery launched in 2007, local food fans in Indianapolis have embraced the concept of the online grocery delivery service that was started in Lawrence by co-founders Matt Ewer and Beth Blessing. You've probably seen the colorful delivery vans and the bright green food bins around your neighborhood for years, but the company just recently had the ribbon cutting for its new 35,000 square foot headquarters and warehouse facility near Interstate 70 and Emerson Avenue in Indianapolis. I stopped in at the new facility to talk with CEO and co-founder Matt Ewer about launching and building the business, which now provides its online home grocery service to dozens of communities across Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Missouri, and Tennessee. It's been, what, 8 years?
Company was founded by me and my wife in 2007.
Okay, so in 2007, what were you thinking? What was your vision then?
My vision was very similar, I think, to where we are today, which was great. I have a lot of people that ask me, did you ever think that your company would be in this position? And quite frankly, I did.
Well, all right. That's good then,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know. I don't want that to come off the wrong way. But, you know, we certainly believe in local food. We certainly believe in local food networking. And we certainly believe in technology. And we saw those things all kind of morphing together to create a different type of atmosphere and a different type of accessibility for local food products.
Like how? A different type of how?
Well, we say convenient, affordable, and accessible. So those things, I think, are in any business that you're in are extremely important. So we wanted to take all the excuses of kind of eating sustainably or eating local or eating healthy and try to remove those barriers for people.
So like, oh, I can't do it because of this or because of that or because of that.
Exactly. You know, I mean, those are the type of things that with our business model, as we developed it, we tried to think about what the barriers were and tried to find solutions for those things.
Oh, so like if I throw up the reason, oh, it's too expensive, you know, so then you figure out how to solve that.
Exactly. I mean, we have a $35 minimum order. So even the conventional home grocers, or when you go to the grocery store, they're all over $35. You go to the grocery store, you know, you're walking out $125 at least. So, you know, we've put a small minimum order on our service, and really people have used our service to kind of put themselves on a budget, both with what they put in their mouths, so what they're actually eating, and how much they're actually spending on it.
Oh, so that's kind of a neat concept, you know, that it makes it budgets two different ways. So that's kind of cool.
Absolutely. One thing about our service a lot of people don't know is that there's nothing unnatural on our website. So there's nothing with preservatives. There are, you know, none of those type of things are available. So when you're shopping with us, you know that you're making a good, healthy choice.
So I'm not going to get the junk. I can't even get the junk there, right?
You can get some natural indulgences, which is different than junk.
Right.
Right. So back in 2007, how was it starting?
How did it start? Very simply with a concept of, you know, a farmer and artisan network. It started with really produce, bread, and dairy. That was kind of our bread and butter, per se. And from there, we got a lot of our customers asking for more right away. Hey, we want you to add frozen meats. Hey, we want you to do this. We want you to do that. So we certainly listen to our customers. They're actually members, so they're repeat customers. So you wouldn't be very smart if you're not listening to repeat members. Also, just being back in the Midwest, we realized very quickly this is the land of what I would say milk and honey. So there's a lot of diversity in farmers and what they're doing, as well as grocery products as well. So as you've seen over the last, you know, 7.5, 8 years since we started our company, there's just been a boom in local food, and that's also a boom for local economy as well. So not only for family farms, important for that aspect, from the food aspect, but also from the local economy aspect.
So now when you started, did people get the idea, you know, were they familiar enough, say, with like CSAs and that sort of thing, so that they understood what you were doing?
Absolutely. I'd like to say right time, right people, right place. You know, right away, there was a hunger for the service. So it took off from day one, and we're very fortunate for that.
So now what was day one like at the very, very beginning?
Sure. Day one was pretty interesting. I mean, I was literally the only person there for one thing. But it was more about, I guess day one would have been before the day one of business, right? Day one was really the concept and the idea. So a lot of that was building our website, was writing our mission statement, was looking at how to form a budget and how to form a business plan. But at the bottom of all that is, what is your gut feeling for what the community needs? Not only the community, but what does the business need, and what's wrong with the food system in general, and trying to create positive solutions for those issues and problems.
So now what problems did you see in the food system that Green Bean is solving?
Sure. To put it in one word, distribution. It's probably the most overlooked aspect of food in general. I mean, even if you know what's going on in the food industry, we're sitting here in our new facility along I-70. I sit here and watch, it's truck after truck that's full of food. A lot of people think about growing a business. They think about growing a product. They think about growing something on their farm. The last thing they probably think about, how am I going to get it to market? And that is logistics and distribution. So we put that and tied that together with a technological solution, a distribution solution, a pack solution, and a kind of market viability solution.
So the idea is that, you know, even if you're growing something, you know, you're a farmer, you're a food artisan or whatever, you can't just pull up the truck at the grocery store and deliver your stuff, right? It just doesn't work that way, right?
It does not work that way, not even close. And, you know, it's about the business model. So, you know, we were crafting that business model, and we were taking a vertically integrated approach, which we have been honing in on over the last 7.5 years to 8 years.
Now, what does that mean?
Vertically integrated just means that we really control every aspect of business from the ground up. I wanted to build a farm from the very beginning. That's why we started our home delivery company. And I didn't trust the greater industry to take care of what I needed to happen off of the farm. So from there, we're one of the only companies that goes from seed to your front door.
So you're growing the food, packaging the food, taking the orders and delivering, right?
Correct. We're growing a portion of the food, sure. Right? So we have many partners that help us with that solution or fill that volume. Obviously, we can't do it all year round. We have 5-6 months, and that's one of the challenges too, is how do you run a business like that? How do you run a farm when you have 5 to 6 months of sales? I mean, those are very, very real challenges for people that are trying to succeed in that line of business.
So how do you do that?
I've done it by matching it with as a portion of a larger business. You know, people don't know our parent company's name Bean, right? So Bean is Biodynamic Education, Agriculture, Nutrition. Green Bean Delivery is one of the entities that's included underneath that umbrella.
Well, now tell me about all the entities under that umbrella.
Sure. We have Green Bean Delivery, which is our home delivery and network of local farmers and artisans, which is basically an online grocery that goes to your door. We have Tiny Footprint Distribution, which does wholesale distribution. So we do some distribution out to other retail stores, mainly natural food grocery stores. What we're trying to do there is kind of build brands, build family brands, and get them to reach their market potential. And then we have Feel Good Farm, which is in Sheridan, Indiana, 60-acre certified organic farm. We do all kinds of produce up there. We do melons, we do lettuces, we do kale, we do chard, we do tomatoes, we do cucumbers, we do peppers, cabbages, et cetera. And then we have Ecohio Farm, which is in Mason, Ohio, which is just outside of Cincinnati. So each one of those farms, those 60-acre certified, they happen to both be 60 acres, are what I call sub-urban. So they're suburban, meaning they're not quite in suburbia, but they're literally right by there. And that's in order to have access for education, have people out to the farm, have it be close enough that people can actually access and get out to the farm and see what we're doing. I want kids to experience, and parents, and non-parents, adults, to experience agriculture and experience what family farms are all about.
So now when you launched, how did the growth happen? Did it grow quickly? I mean, you're out here now in this lovely new headquarters. How did the growth happen? How big were you when you started?
We were relatively small, but the growth did happen pretty quickly. You know, we were first to market with this concept in the Midwest, and that certainly helps. And the fact that we kind of hit the nail on the head with the concept obviously helps as well. We have remained family-owned and operated. We are 100% owned by the Ewer family. We're very proud of that because in the food industry, there's not a lot of people that are able to do that any longer. We admire certain companies that have been able to do that, like Clif Bar. You know, I've read the Clif Bar book. It was very influential on some of my decisions that I make. And being family-owned and operated means that we don't necessarily have to answer to anybody. We answer to our customers and our members, and they're the most important people to us. And that enables us to not live and die by the P&L. We certainly have to answer to it, but we don't have to live and die by it. And we can go out there and be more mission driven and be more of a social entrepreneur that's trying to create solutions for our community to live healthy and enjoy food. After all, food's just a great celebration.
We've been talking with Green Bean Delivery co-founder and CEO Matt Ewer about how the local grocery delivery business got started. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio for more on Green Bean Delivery and the Bean family of companies and how it's growing after this. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Green Bean Delivery, which launched an online grocery home delivery service in 2007 in the Indianapolis area, has become known for its ubiquitous green bins and the local and regional foods that fill them. Now the company has a new 35,000 square foot headquarters and plans to create up to 105 new jobs by 2024. I talked recently with co-founder and CEO Matt Ewer about where the company is going and how it will continue to grow. So let's talk a little bit about where the company is going, you know, from here. So tell me a little bit about the new headquarters.
Well, we're right off of Emerson and I-70 here in Indianapolis. We built a DC as well as a headquarters, so a distribution center, as well as a corporate headquarters. So it matches our office facility needs with the ability to buy and sell a little bit differently with more capacity and things like that. So where the company is going to go from here, continue to grow its home delivery. We truly believe in what we do, and we've seen the impact that our business has on family farms and on our partners. So we truly believe in that. We just expanded to Nashville in January, Nashville, Tennessee. So that's our sixth metro market. We see the farm continuing to grow. You know, one of the hardest industries is fresh fruits and vegetables. You don't see a lot of people doing it. you certainly don't see a lot of people ramping that up to really gain brand recognition and really understand how to make an impact and hopefully influence future people to get involved in the industry. As the demand goes up for local food, where's the supply going to come from? And that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer, and that's why we went back to the farm from our home delivery to go back and say, hey, we need to get our boots on the ground. We really need to ramp this side of our business up to create agricultural solutions for future generations.
So in ramping that up, do you anticipate expanding the farms, more farms, that sort of thing?
I do. We're already in talks to expand acreage as of this year. We've got some really cool partnerships. I can't quite let them out of the bag yet. When I do, I'll call you up, and we'll have another conversation. But we've got some really cool, exciting things happening that are both based in nonprofit from an educational standpoint and for-profit in the aspect of volume and really making a farm that actually cranks out food. So, yeah.
So now what does it take to do that? You know, you mentioned that not a lot of the fruit and vegetable farms are expanding. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges to do that? Because it seems like there needs to be more of that.
There does need to be more, and from a food security standpoint, from a national standpoint, there needs to be more of it. A lot of people look at that as it's just a local issue or a local problem. When you've got California drying up, and they produce a great portion of certified organic vegetables and fruit, we really need to think about that as a nation. And that creates instability from a pricing standpoint. If something happens, let's say in Florida, a freeze comes in late, or something happens in Cali where there's a drought, and all of a sudden, you know, a large portion of one commodity like broccoli is not on the marketplace, the price of that product is going to fluctuate, drastically. So it's important to think about that from a national aspect. The reason that it's not here is because it's the toughest business in the world. It is, there's so many variables to it. You're dealing with Mother Nature. You're dealing with a marketplace that's based on a national level when you have local challenges. So, you know, somebody may have an advantage of being able to grow all year. Somebody might have, which is obviously easier to run your business that way because you've got more sales. So a lot of those things, I think, our company at Green Bean Delivery and the support that our members have given us, they're buying into something that's bigger. They're buying into something that has more identity to it than just a brick-and-mortar grocery store. And by that, what I mean is part of the challenge for us to do what we do has to come through the support of Green Bean Delivery members because they continually support us all year, so we can put that money back into the farm each and every year, and we continue to grow that. Part of the challenge is you've got to have capital. So you've got to have capital investments. You've got to have a post-harvest production facility. A lot of people that are just existing off of growing fruits and vegetables can't get over that hump. They can't buy the equipment that they need. They can't get the people that they need. They can't provide the HR to keep the people that they need. So there's a lot of those challenges that I think Green Bean Delivery helps us alleviate.
Now, you also talked about your own brand. You know, now tell me a little bit about that.
Which brand? Farm to Kitchen Foods?
Yes.
Well, we have a private label brand, Farm to Kitchen Foods, and Farm to Kitchen Foods is only available through Green Bean Delivery. And what we focused on with Farm to Kitchen is basically fresh products. So we do a lot of bulk product. Like if you went into a store and saw all the bulk goods, we will put that in a package for you, put nutritional information on there for you, put the ingredients that are listed on there for you, and make that in a sealable bag. We're interested in doing things like cut fruit and eventually adding a deli component of what we do.
Really?
Yeah.
So what are some other ideas or products or different aspects of the company that maybe, you know, you're thinking about, or we could, you know, look for down the road a ways?
We've always thought about restaurants. You know, maybe we get into that directly off of our farm. I am always challenging my marketing department to what I call think outside of the bin, right? Everybody knows us for our green bin. So I think we're at the precipice as a business of understanding how to utilize our assets. And that's always a challenge for a person that's leading a company, is to get people to say, don't do the same old trick. I know that it's safe. I know that it looks good and all those type of things, but we have to continue to challenge ourselves to understand what people are looking for and what services they're going to be looking for. The main thing that we're working on is tech. So how do we improve technology? We put over $1 million into software over the last couple years. We built our own software service, our own program here in-house, and that enables us to then have a solid foundation to put bells and whistles on, and to do things like menu features or have you be able to order a product like a pizza, right? Then get all your ingredients with it. So those are some of the things that we're working on now.
Now tell me a little bit about your own background and how you came to be doing this and how the idea sort of came to you.
I'm a lifelong food person. I started selling sweet corn door to door off my family farm when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So I've always been an entrepreneur. It just inherently is in my blood. I can't help it. Sometimes I wish I could, but I can't. From there, I went to IU, stayed within as I worked through school, I continued to work in the food service industry. So I was with Scholars and Bakehouse for a while. I drove up to Indy and handled the Indianapolis route while I was in college. And then I worked for Strangers Hill, which was a certified organic farm. But I knew by the time I was 19 that I was going to run my own company and start my own company, and that's what I wanted to do. So I wasn't going through school necessarily to get a conventional job out of school. I was going to school to hopefully, obviously gain an education, hopefully some wisdom alongside of that, and understand. I went to SPIA, so School of Public and Environmental Affairs, I got a degree in environmental management. And I've used that degree and what I learned there to try to make an impact through my business as a social mission-driven business. From there, I went to Seattle, where my wife went to get her master's degree in nutrition, and I met my mentor out there, Andrew Stout. He worked for he owned a company called Full Circle Farm. I ran a CSA, and through that, we started to build software. Started to manage the farm as well. And while I started to manage the farm, we morphed that CSA into a network more where we were buying and selling off of other people and growing that food ourselves. We ended up taking that to Alaska, where people would order up in Alaska, and we would take Washington State-grown family farm food in a couple different ways up to Alaska. So that's really where I got my experience from. So by the time I started my company, we started it with next to nothing, but we had a boatload of experience.
We've been talking with Green Bean Deliveries, Matt Ewer. For more information on the company, go to greenbeandelivery.com. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. Here at Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we always like to explore what's happening in the cocktail community locally. So this week we checked in with local bartender Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar, who recently competed in the Diageo World Class 2015 Bartender Competition in Cleveland. Ryan, who has also competed in numerous competitions on the local, regional, and national level, told us what it was like at the World Class 2015 competition.
So I had met several people who had done World Class before. I did a large competition earlier in the year, Woodford, and a couple of people that I was competing against had already done World Class and were planning on doing it again. And one of my judges, Charles Jolie, was the winner last year.
Very famous guy.
About as famous as a bartender can get. And he wanted... I had several conversations with him about it, and then he came back. He came to town a couple months after Woodford and did a world-class seminar with Ricky Gomez, another guy who's won it, who I've met a couple times. And it just... I wasn't sure if I wanted to enter this year or not, but it just kind of led up to this thing. I was like, you know what, why not give it a shot and just see what it's like.
But it's kind of an involved process to apply for something like this, right?
Yeah, the application process is about as rigorous as the gets. It's a... I think it took me probably 2 days to finish my application. It's a lot of short essays asking you questions about your bartending experience. Where do you see yourself as a bartender? Where do you see trends in bartending going, what inspires you. You had to submit a cocktail. Very, very long process. They asked for a mentor's reference, and eventually they ended up doing like a background check on me, which luckily I haven't gotten into too much trouble. And yeah, then they let me know that, you know, you're one of the 15 regional finalists. So what they do with the states is they break it down into five regions, and each region has 15 people competing.
So who were some of the, where were some of the people from that you were competing against?
So a third of them were from Chicago, go figure. And the three people who won the actual competition were from Chicago. There was a couple people from Michigan. There was a dude from Madison, Wisconsin. St. Louis was in there. Kansas City.
So this is a big area that you were one of the participants from. So that's a lot of people who must have applied just to get to that regional competition.
Yeah, they don't tell you how many people apply, but yeah, the Midwest is a big region, maybe one of the biggest ones. And honestly, I mean, from everything I've heard, it's one of the toughest regions to compete in because there's a lot of really good people in the Midwest. Yeah, and there were a few people in there from Ohio as well.
So what was it like? So what happened when you got there?
So they flew us in to Cleveland. So that's exciting. I'd never been to Cleveland before. That's really cool. So they had us at a hotel, and we went out to a nice. We had a little reception dinner at the Black Pig in Cleveland. Really, really tasty place. And that was our chance to kind of sit down and meet everybody and interact, converse.
Nice bunch of people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from everything I've experienced so far. You put a group of bartenders in a room together, and, you know, there's usually not going to be too much of an issue. You know, once the liquor gets flowing, people start laughing, and it's a good time. Everybody clicks pretty quickly. So we all just kind of got to know each other, talking about our experiences, and, you know, why'd you do World Class? At this point, you know, there's nothing to hide. Like, hey, what are you doing for this event? And then we went to a couple. They took us to a couple bars after that, and then we called an early night because we had to be up at about 8 in the morning the next day.
So competition,
which is very early for bartender.
So competition started the next day, right?
Yeah. So it was a 3-day process. Competition was the next day. Started. We had to be on the bus at 9. Yeah. So we were all on the bus at 9. They got us over to the competition area. We were able to kind of unload our stuff because everybody had all these tools and, you know, accoutrements and different things for various presentations.
So you had to bring all that stuff with you, right?
Yeah. I mean, they provided if you really wanted to, they would provide. They provided basic glassware and basic tools. I think at that level, most people don't do that. And I brought some of my own glassware, and unfortunately, a lot of it got broken in transit. Because I had to check the bag, but I had Michael Toscano, our bar manager, was coming up for the USBG Cleveland conference, so he was able to grab me some extra stuff, thankfully. So yeah, we got unpacked, and then we had kind of an orientation meeting. They showed us so there were three challenges in the competition. They showed us where each three would be held, because each was held in a different room concurrently. They introduced us to the judges that would be judging each room, and gave us the order of, you know, they broke us into groups of five. And so your five would be working on one presentation while another five would be working on another presentation, and then you rotate.
So what were the challenges that you had to do?
So the first one that I had to do, was it's called the Ritual Theater, Lights, Camera, Action, where you take a Diageo brand reserve spirit, like Johnny Walker, or I did Tanqueray 10. There's some other ones. I don't remember what all of them were. I did Tanqueray 10, and essentially what they asked you to do was do a bottle service presentation.
Now this is kind of complicated, right?
That was kind of the wild card. I don't think anybody really knew how to approach that. Like, everybody had ideas, but as far as I understood, like, everybody did something completely different. But what they wanted you to do was, like you know, if you have a customer sit down at your bar and, you know, they want to taste a spirit, treat it like that. But So the theme this year for World Class is Lights, Camera, Action.
So did it had to, like, incorporate that theme somehow?
Yeah, like, they wanted you to theme it around a scene from a movie or an actor or a movie itself. So I did Harry Potter. I did Tanqueray 10, and I treated it like a potions class.
That's kind of cool.
It was fun. It was actually really fun. So I had all the botanicals for Tanqueray 10 in front of the judges, and we walked through each one as the ingredients to the elixir that is Tanqueray 10. They had a really good time. I got to make Ricky Gomez wear a silly witch hat, and it was fun. And Ricky told me, at least in his books, that I was one of the better of that ritual theater. So that made me feel really good. I think that's the one I did the best in. Because I'm a creative person at heart. I enjoy theatrics.
You have an arts background, right?
Yeah. I have a fine art background. So, making sure that I had a visually cool layout and thinking in a... it takes you out of the drink making mode, and you really puts you into a really different mindset. And it's funny to see that many really really talented bartenders kind of freaking out about something that, realistically is kind of simple, but it's still a very creative. That one really challenged you mentally, I think.
Well, it's kind of a performance, maybe even more so.
Absolutely a performance piece. One of the guys did. Glengarry Glen Ross, he did the Alec Baldwin scene, and he was like screaming at the judges. I know Liz Pierce from Chicago, who almost won, she did American Psycho, and she had she had all the lights turned off in the room when the judges came in, and then she had the sounds of a chainsaw on iTunes linked up to a Bluetooth speaker that was cranked all the way up. So these judges were sitting there like wondering what the hell's going on. And then all of a sudden she blasts chainsaw noises. And she made Debbie scream quite a bit, apparently. And then she turned the lights and she was covered in blood. I think the takeaway is that, Indianapolis really isn't that far behind everybody else. I mean, we have a really talented scene right now. And I think for me, the reason I've been more compelled to do these national competitions is because I've been curious to see, where I'm at and where the bar's at and where the city's at on a national scale. And I think, it behooves us to represent ourselves on a national scale because that just it feeds back into us.
Well, I think we feel like we might be way behind, but maybe we're not so way behind.
I don't think we are. I mean, I'm definitely not the best bartender in the city, and I was able to make it to a national competition this year and a regional competition. I think we have some serious talents, and I think we're only going to get better. The reason I like these national competitions is, I've competed at a local level, but I feel like a lot of times I end up competing against the same people a lot of times.
Good point. So you were able to test yourself against people completely different, right?
Right, and learn from people that are way far my superiors, and I've been doing all this crazy. I met Liz Pierce, who's the Chicago Speed Rack champion, and I met people that they're opening their own bar or about to, and hey, we're doing this technique in my bar, we're doing this technique in my bar, and it really gives you a much grander vision of what's going on in the nation. And as much as it sucks energy out of you to do it, you come back to your city way more inspired. It just makes you better, and it makes you want to do it again. I'm definitely going to go back next year and keep doing it until I make it to the national level.
Well, we've been talking with bartender Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio for more from Ryan here on WFYI and WFYI.org. The cocktail culture in Indianapolis has exploded in recent years, and interest in new and classic cocktails has never been greater. Our cocktail bars are getting national attention, and our bartenders are competing in events all over the country. But how do they come up with those creative drinks we see on local cocktail menus? Bartender Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar, who just competed in the Diageo World Class 2015 competition in Cleveland, walks us through how he comes up with a new cocktail.
That's one jumping off point, is reinterpreting, hey, I want to take an old fashioned, but I don't want to make it with whiskey. I want to make it with a different spirit, or I want to use an old fashioned build, which allows
the spirit to really stand out, and I want to use that as a jumping off point to accentuate a flavor. Like, I really want somebody to taste rosemary. I'm going to make a rosemary whiskey and build it in an old-fashioned style.
For me, it's always been kind of a very free-form process. I know when I first started bartending, it was kind of like a shotgun, like throw crap in a glass and hope something that sticks. And for whatever reason, I've always had a fairly decent palate, so I know how flavors work, and I understand how flavors go together.
Now, is that something you've tried to cultivate?
Yeah, I think it's gotten better as I've gotten a little bit more seasoned. I think as you sit there and you try spirits and you sit down with people that are professionals and they taste them with you and they explain this to you, explain that to you, your mind starts to develop a mental picture of how this stuff really works, and then eventually you get to the point where it becomes kind of second nature. I usually take a concept or an idea or a flavor and I build off of that. I don't usually have an ultimate end goal. It's usually like one of my more successful cocktails was a cocktail called The Gathering Storm. I knew I wanted to do a coffee infused bourbon because I just thought those flavors would go very well together. But I was like, well, I don't want to just do coffee and I want to add another accentuating flavor. And I knew it was going to be a stirred cocktail, so I wanted to add a little bit of citric to it because I knew that that would brighten it up a little bit. So I was like, well, let's look. There's a really great book called The Flavor Bible. Consulted that, and I saw the orange pairs well with coffee. So I did a coffee and orange infused bourbon. So I had to make the infusion. So I had to decide which bourbon to infuse. We ended up using Backbone because it's a really high-proof bourbon, which makes good for infusions because it really leaches out the flavor. So then I have my bourbon. So where do I go from here? Coffee flavor. I need a sweetener now. You know, a simple syrup would be nice, but I want to add another level of flavor. Let's add orgeat, which is almonds. Almonds and coffee would work well together. Almonds and orange would work well together. So there's a sweetener. And then I know that traditionally, Fernet and coffee are very popular in Italy as like a hangover remedy. So I decided, okay, let's put a splash of Fernet in there with it. And then just a few dashes of bitters to kind of round it all out.
And it worked?
Yeah, that kind of cocktail was my best-selling cocktail ever. Eventually, yeah, you have to figure out your recipe, like your build, too. That one took a little bit of tweaking. That was one of my best sellers. We got a big batch of it barrel-aging in the back now, too, which is kind of exciting. That should be pretty fun. But yeah, I mean, usually for me, it's a step-by-step. Like, I'll have a grand vision or a grand idea that I want to encapsulate, and then I just figure out a way to get there. One of the great things about having an awesome kitchen, too, is that we're able to kind of reach out to them, you know, and say, like, hey, what are you working on?
Right.
You know, do you have some jams that I could try out, or, like, pickle juice, or, what's a cool ingredient or a flavor that would work well with this? And that's something that I like to do, is just cross paths with my kitchen as much as possible, because they understand.
Like, you know,
they can bring in ideas that I normally wouldn't understand. Like, Paul, that just walked past us, he's the one that suggested using buttermilk.
Now that was really good.
Yeah. So I mean, I've been using yogurt, and Paul suggested buttermilk, and I was like, all right, cool. And I gave it a shot, and I've been using buttermilk in cocktails ever since.
I like that.
Yeah. So it's fun where it's I like having that collaboration too. Like as much as I like making drinks on my own, sometimes a collaboration is equally as successful, if not more so. But this one was just actually something I made up. Actually made this up on Sunday. And it turned out really, really good. For Neil, actually, he wanted a light, refreshing tequila cocktail. And for whatever reason, I really wanted to do something with a whole egg in it. I was just in the mood for that. Neil really likes tequila. He just got back from Mexico. We decided to do a little bit of tequila. And then I wanted to use... I knew I was going to put pineapple in it. And I really like... allspice with pineapple and tequila. So I threw a little bit of that in there too. I used the Cabeza tequila, which is a really, really great Blanco tequila. It's a winter fermentation tequila, so you get this, like it ferments longer, and so you get this really, really strong agave flavor out of it. It's really great in cocktails. Pineapple and tequila are like my two favorite things. And then I found myself a lot lately using lemon and lime together. because they both have different levels of citric acid, and I think they complement each other well. So if I have the time, usually I'll throw both in there in equal parts, and just I think it just adds a level of flavor that you wouldn't get otherwise. And then agave nectar as the sweetener, because we got tequila in there, agave nectar, that makes sense. And then the whole egg. Shake it up. Any cocktail that has egg, you want to shake it beforehand without the egg. Or without the ice, so you get the egg frothed up, but you don't dilute it. There's the ice.
That's beautiful.
The whole egg really adds a nice silkiness to it. The spirits that we have in there are Tequila Cabeza from 86 Company and St. Elizabeth Allspice Dram, which is an allspice-based liqueur. Pineapple juice, lemon juice, lime juice, agave nectar, a pinch of salt, a coarse salt, and an egg, a whole egg. Shaked up, strained into a large coupe. And then I zested some lime and some nutmeg on top.
And what's it called?
Viejo Amigo.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, the old friend.
That's old friend, right?
Yeah.
We've been talking with bartender Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar, which is located at 608 Massachusetts Avenue in Indianapolis. For more information, go to libertineindy.com. You've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Thanks for tuning in this week, and thanks also to our guests, Rita Franco of the La Mexigringa Tamale Business here in Indianapolis, Matt Ewer of Green Bean Delivery, and also to Ryan Puckett of the Libertine Liquor Bar. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.